even for perishable foods, so we're talking about things like fish or ice cream, are in the low teens. So you can imagine the explosion if China does manage to adopt the cold chain that the U.S. has. You can imagine the explosion in refrigeration that will bring. And so obviously that's something that will be disruptive to the entire world.
Thank you, Tabitha. Tabitha, do you, I know we were discussing that kind of adoption and what that looks like from your perspective in Brazil.
Yeah. Bom dia. Olá, first of all. I want to thank the Institute for the invitation. It's been a huge pleasure to participate on GFO. I've been working with food since I started to work and it's all my life. I did a gastronomy course at university and worked in many restaurants since then. I continued my education in history and public policies and stayed the last 4 years working with food system at City Hall in São Paulo, my city. Nowadays, I'm freelancing and working on my first book. My main expertise is to cook and to teach people how to cook, but I see myself as a food consultant in general, as I feel comfortable to develop projects in many areas of food chain. I believe in the whole and integrated way to and vision about food, especially when you grow it and when you cook it. You can reach amazing results if you go beyond the technique, using amplified insights and backgrounds from other areas of knowledge to improve your job and everything. So the other aspect I see with huge importance in the is the equilibrium between the traditional culinary techniques and ways to preserve food and all this technology that are present as food service scenario today, because we kind of have to avoid and prevent the cultural loss that this can cause to immaterial heritage around here, because we have some kind of processor way to preserve food like farofa or farinha that we can think about refrigerating them because it will worse and waste them. So I don't know. Probably I agree with Nicola. I think the cold chain will change here like China because we are growing in this aspect. We now have more than 90% of our country having electric grids and refrigerators, but we have less than 50% that have freezers. So I don't know, maybe, but I'm here ready to exchange and share knowledge with you folks. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tabitha. And Matt Naruto, who's...
Hello.
Hello.
I'm on.
Welcome, Matt.
I didn't try a webcam, so I just did, I guess. So I'm on the conversation to talk about an experiment that we're doing here in Ithaca, New York, specifically to try and grow the amount of locally raised meats that are consumed in our region. We're just trying to reinvent the meat locker or the freezer locker that was really popular in the U.S. until about the mid-40s. This is a communal freezer space that people can rent. And I came into it from an ag economist perspective and on the farmer side, but on the consumer side, it's really interesting what the introduction of home freezers did to the way that people eat meat and the changes that we've seen. And we're only a few months into this project, so we don't have our communal freezer open yet. That should be in the next 2 months, but there's been tremendous interest. And I think to our initial goal, we will get more households eating locally sourced meat with this freezer resource. And in this conversation about home refrigeration and home freezers that all developed in the late 40s and became, you know, more commonly used, you have to add in the conversation about the introduction of grocery stores. Again, I'm going to really focus on meat because that's what my little experiment has to do with. But at that time, people would buy meat from a local farm, store it down at the freezer plant or the locker plant, we're calling ours the meat locker, and then come down once a week and get a few cuts out of their side or half an animal, quarter of an animal. With the advent of home refrigeration, home freezers, and grocery stores, people could just walk into a store, get any cut that they want handed to them. And so the meat consumption really changed. And in essence, I guess here in Ithaca, we're trying to bring it back to more locally sourced and eating the whole animal. That's all I'll say for introduction.
Thank you, Matt. So as Nicola was saying, that there was a period in the history of communal use of refrigeration and freezing, and part of what you're doing is sort of going back to that, back to the future, as it were. Now, talking with Nicola earlier, we were discussing the role of that, of the transformative role of the freezer and refrigeration in the home. And Nicola, you mentioned something really remarkable about the role that refrigeration plays in home social dynamics, that it was sort of took me by surprise and is very different than the discussion around family meals per se. I was wondering if you could share that now.
Yeah, and there's a very interesting study out of UCLA recently, which was looking at what they called middle class families and just looking at their life at home. It was a multi-year, super in-depth anthropological study of people at home. And they looked at many, many things. I mean, for example, the fact that no one uses their backyard, even in LA, which is super sad. But one of the more interesting things was about the role that the refrigerator plays in family life. And the fact that they would do these studies, it was called a scan sample, every 10 minutes, just studying where everyone in the family is. And then those densely sort of clustered pack of dots representing people is in front of the fridge. And their hypothesis is the fridge is the new hearth. It's the center of the family. It's not just people opening it and grazing, although that is a large part of it. It's also that the fridge door is where then all the information clusters to run the family, and that the fridge has become, the 21st century hearth. It is where the family sort of gathers. It gathers in a much more distributed and sort of fragmented way than it might have in the past, but it plays that role, which I think is very interesting. It is the sort of the focal point of a family's foodscape. It just isn't necessarily a social activity or at least in the way that we would, or a social place in the way that we would understand it, thinking back to the history of the family meal and so on.
Mm-hmm. So sort of shifting what sociality means in that context of the family.
Exactly. And as I said to you as well, I mean, I think it's important to remember that the family meal is a point in time. It's not like this thing that humans have always done for all time, and now we're moving away for the first time ever. It had the family dinner particularly has like a 100-year run, and that's about, I mean, if it's ending, then that is, that will be its era. It was an introduction in the Industrial Revolution as people worked away from home and couldn't get home for lunch, which was previously the main meal of the day. And it also built on Victorian era sort of ideas of etiquette and, being able to judge people's class and background by how they ate and also Victorian era ideals about the family and the way that parents and children should relate and the importance of the family unit as opposed to, say, a more communal environment. So one of the alternative dinner models that started in the Industrial Revolution was the communal model, where people would eat together in a large, village hall type atmosphere and not together as a family. And that died out and never really found the favor that a family meal did. So again, it's that idea that there are other models and these things are sort of rooted at a particular point in time. But we can you know, pick out which parts are useful, basically.
And what we want to explore in the future. I just like to pause and remind people of a few things. One, that we are recording this to share on the website, and so if you are not speaking, please do mute your microphone so that we don't hear your toaster ding and that sort of background noise. Also, we're going to continue this discussion until 9:30, and specifically that last half hour, we are looking for your questions and your responses submitted through WebEx and through all sorts of social media and email. So please do, as you're listening to this discussion, bear that in mind and send those questions our way. Now, Nicola, you mentioned sort of community, communal dining and community experiences, and it reminded me of the signals that Tabitha has been sharing with me lately around the resurgence of shared eating experiences and sort of the connection to the sharing movement in Brazil. I'm wondering, Tabitha, could you tell us a little bit about what that looks like and how that is intersecting with technology?
Yeah, of course. When I received the questions and when we talked about to do this virtual exchange, I started to think about all this, and the first thing that came to my mind is not how, but why people socialize and gather around food. And in the past, I think we had a lot of reasons to do that. Probably it was the easier and the safer way to survive. And the process of, from getting or from nature and to store, to eat together and to cook and share everything as a community, it was probably the only way we knew how to do. But today we have other reasons, don't we? I think we have to think about the experience. We share and we gather to connect, to be closer to our nature and other reasons is very different. And in Brazil, we are facing this huge trend now because everybody wants to share something, the experience, like go to a farm together, pick up the food, cook together, have this together, and the whole conversation around the food, then back to your home together at the same car. It's a huge, huge trend. It's a forecast. Like, they have sites. One of them called Farofala. That's so nice because if you can do, you, Mira, if you come to Brazil and you want to present a California way to cook, you can subscribe there and you just share with your friends around here, and then they can do the subscription and go to your house and eat your food and pay for them. It's experience. The food isn't to buy food just for buying or for feeding. And I think it's nice to see things in a different way, using technology, but back into roots, back into the old way to do things. That's it.
Mm-hmm. So the technology is really coordinating social experience. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Tabitha, I love the way you just said that, the idea of kind of going back to go forward. And I think, Matt, what you talked about and touched on in your intro is relevant to that conversation. You know, theoretically, the concept of refrigeration, like you said, is you know, a new one on the grand historical scale, but actually now to us sort of a relatively old one that we take for granted. But how do you think that new models like a freezer locker, not only economically but also from a community perspective, will help change, first of all, a local food system, but then actually can have a more broad impact around the food system in general, if these systems and technologies kind of start to spread?
Well, there's a few ways. One is the natural idea of people coming together. We're only going to have limited distribution hours, so every member of the Fraser, ideally they'll come on one of our two distribution days each week and meet up. From a local food system perspective, it's a great, you know, there's so much buzz in our local food world nationwide right now about food hubs, and I'm shying away from that word, but we're going to do lots of food distribution during the meat locker hours. So in other words, someone's storing meat down there, they'll come during our 4 to 6 hours that we're open, they'll access their share of meat, get out what they need for the week, but they'll also be able to pick up a vegetable CSA share. I assume everyone is familiar with the concept of a CSA. But we'll have local farms distributing produce, bread and cheese during the same hours. And I think another great, you know, technology enables, let's say, individuals and households to become less dependent on their community. And so what we're doing with this communal freezer space is getting people to come back together again. And I expect people to be sharing, exchanging, and trading off their meat supply with each other. And as much as we already have people buying bulk quantities of meat, like I mentioned, quarters and halves, they're already doing a lot of that. I help with some local meat distribution now, and people are coming together, they're talking, they're sharing, and it's an opportunity to bring people back together over their food instead of giving them the technology to stay apart from each other. And I guess the last thing I throw in there in terms of access is that the reason we introduced a communal freezer space is because meat purchased this way is more affordable. So again, I'm referencing my experience in this area, but local foods tend to be a little more costly, and we have this great advantage with meat where it actually becomes more affordable than grocery store meat when you purchase this way. So we're really hoping to open this door to local foods to a lot more sense.
I just want to build on what Matt said really quickly, because I think it's incredibly interesting that this, even the locker idea as a word, is something that Amazon has now picked up on. You know, Amazon lockers where you can go and pick up your parcels. And one of the things that's been interesting to me as I'm looking at China and refrigeration is that China is sort of skipping well, that's not true, but China is on a parallel track at the same time that they're getting the Walmarts that we have. There's also a large chunk of the population that is now skipping past that and going straight to online food ordering and food delivery. And when I was apartment hunting in New York, one of the things that was curious to me is that an amenity in New York now is the Fresh Direct room. And it's a room full of refrigerators, one for each apartment in the building, where your Fresh Direct order can be left while you're out at work. And so just thinking of those various strands and sort of what Matt is also describing, I just think there's an opportunity, and this is one of those moments where thoughtful design could make a much more social process with, the opportunity to swap leftovers too, or maybe you have something that's, you know, about to, or you made too much of something. Maybe, you know, maybe you can design those spaces in the apartment blocks of the future where it's not just a space for your online delivery to come to you personally in your personal fridge. Maybe it's a space where more sharing can be facilitated and, you know, and we can start to reduce wastage as well and build sociality around food sharing and community, et cetera. And with a larger definition than just, you know, the nuclear unit of the family, or particularly as we sort of more and more live alone, just sort of an individual relationship with food.
It's funny, I was actually just going to ask you this question, because I think something that I've talked a lot about when sort of defending the general concept that the food system could entirely change is these new models of how we buy food. I think there's so many assumptions built into the supermarket or the hypermarket that, hey, those big ships can't actually be turned. And like Matt was saying with something like meat, you know, maybe that big ship can't be turned for most consumers, but if we completely break apart that system and people are literally buying food, storing food, preserving food in an entirely different way that doesn't necessitate a supermarket, that's actually where some of these major systems will be broken apart. So I was going to bring up the sort of New York City fresh direct room model and see if you've seen other models like that, you know, when looking at refrigeration that could actually be transformative, not just to the eaters themselves, but actually to the community and to the food system in general.
I think one of the biggest places and most exciting things will be to see how this develops in entire countries that are remaking their food systems. So a place like China has the chance to really reinvent an entire way of doing business. But even within the U.S., you get opportunities to reinvent it. And I think what Matt is doing is amazing. I also come across a really interesting team in Oakland, a similar, using the fresh direct model, but using it for using its efficiency to make local food and sustainably sourced food much more cost effective. Because obviously a grocery store, you know, although they have efficiencies by doing everything at such a scale, they also have overhead. And if you can eliminate that, but keep some of the efficiencies of scale, you have an opportunity to remake the model. And so then it's just it's sort of incumbent on us as consumers, but also people who are setting up these systems to think about all the ways that they can build in the community aspect. You know, what I love about what Matt is doing is the way of thinking of the whole animal. And so ways of being able to sort of one of the interesting things about refrigeration is it really disconnects you from where your food comes from, because refrigeration is sort of like a space-time travel machine. You can move food all across the country and make it last like 6 months out of season. And if you can find creative ways to sort of overcome that effect and go back to the idea of where food comes from, still while using the amazing anti-food waste powers of refrigeration, then you're really on something.
We're really at sort of a turning point in imagining whether these technologies can really enable much more individualistic consumption than even grocery stores. If you're not coming together at one place in time, but you're just having food come directly to you, or to design sociality into that system and use it to reconnect people with multiple points. That's sort of similar to what you're seeing, Tabitha, in Brazil, of sort of deliberately trying to use these technologies to maintain or preserve knowledge of food processes and preservation. You were telling me also about sort of processes of preserving food without refrigeration and how people create community around and are trying to maintain community around that. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, Tabitha?
Yeah. And it's nice to think about that, because it's a huge trend on the high-level restaurants that face high gastronomy and high prices and everything to use these techniques to share the best of their creativity or culinary to the clients. And it's amazing because I was thinking about what Nicola and Mike was saying, and here we have the municipal markets that are disappearing, and they treat the food and the storage like that. They have the common locker, the common freezer for all the vendors from the municipal market, and they share the animal with many commercial guys from there, and I think this is quite trendy here together, because we are now sensing the local food trend. Everybody wants to know how food comes to their dishes, to their plates, and to their fridge. So we are looking for restorability and where food comes from. So with patient like a decrease on sales by freezers from 90s from now, we have around 50%, but we had houses almost 20% in 92, that houses in Brazil had freezers. And now we are decreasing these numbers because it isn't trained anymore. We don't want processed food. We want to buy the fresh food and to have this food in our fridge is different to have in our freezers. I don't know if this trend of back to the natural way to see things and back to the roots will perdure around here, because people want to do things in the fast way of life, fast manners and fast everything. I think this is the worst that technology can bring to us, because we don't want to wait anything anymore. We don't want to wait to grow anymore. So probably I think this is the worst thing that can have the loneliness and the fast manners to leave, and less meeting reunions, less table reunions, less table conversations, I think. But it depends.
Mm-hmm. So there's really some conflict there between the sort of slow food and wanting to know where all of your food comes from, and a desire for a faster lifestyle, and really trying to reconcile those. How and you mentioned sort of people gathering around the table. How is that expressed in terms of how people do gather together and frame and talk about social gathering and social eating?
I think we have two different ways. We have rich people that want to have to experience everything, like in Europe or in the United States or anywhere all over the world. It's different than class C or B around here, because it's like one point before the train. When rich people are looking for farina with the best chef in Brazil, that Alex Atala, to use the indigenous ways of cooking in his creativity of culinary, poor people can pay for this creativity. They just can pay for the farina, but the farina, only the farina, without the creativity of the chef, around here isn't nice. But to reach, it is. Then we face this dualist way to see things. Probably more 20 years, when class B and C start to see that this is nice to class AAA. We are start to do like weekly, because things worse. Like, I don't know why. I really don't know why.
So you think it's really on a longer term curve of change? Yeah.
Yeah, probably. And that there's I think that is the necessity of some cities, of some people that need to live like that, because they don't have a fridge or they don't have a connection to the electricity. The electricity grid, but it's different. It's different. We are not talking about experience. We are talking about hunger and feeding. It's very, very different.
Well, I'm gonna jump in, because I think that's actually very relevant. But also another comment that Nicola made that I want to throw to Matt is, and I think this is also so interesting, the idea of regions and places skipping certain technologies. So Nicola was saying that about China, is that maybe they're sort of skipping the Walmart model of food purchasing and instead kind of shifting right into buying online. I often use the similar example of the continent of Africa essentially skipping landlines and going right to mass use of cell phones. But in food, I think that's the interesting thing is that very different regions in our country today are often interfacing with this very differently. It seems like a lot of the bastions of technology like Silicon Valley and the San Francisco Bay Area, where there's, you know, a lot of sort of expansive use and development of technology, are also have a very progressive food system. But Matt, you're operating in an area with maybe a different population, although Ithaca, the Ithaca area is obviously a very progressive food scene. But how is your sense of this entirely new technology that maybe is even skipping, you know, having the whole massive infrastructure of big box stores or whatever it is, how is your population of eaters responding to this idea? Or is it a different population? And is it responding, is the population responding to the idea well?
Yeah, good question. There's a joke about Ithaca, you know, it's a little 10 square miles surrounded by reality. So we wanted to test this idea out in Ithaca where locally grown foods are embraced and there's a great local food economy going on, although we found that meat was one place that was underrepresented. The kinds of Ithacans and people in our county that have expressed interest have surprised me a little bit. I guess I expected interest from foodies, graduate students, and apartment dwellers, and we've certainly heard from those people. We were hoping to also get a lot of interest from low-income households that are not, you know, typically getting access to local food or to fresh, healthy foods, because of that we're really talking about the affordability and we have some grant funds to offset the cost. We want to approach low-income households and even envision two or three households sharing a portion. But other groups that we didn't expect to hear from are off-grid, farmsteads and green home type people, senior citizens, and then while we were planning this, we found out there is a meat locker operating in our region that's specifically for the Amish community, because you talk about skipping technology. The Amish reject a lot of technology, and they don't have home refrigeration. They don't use electric in their homes. So they store things down at one communal freezer. We're also testing the meat locker model. While we're testing it in Ithaca, where, like I said, we sort of expected it to succeed, we're also testing it in another more rural city nearby called Corning. It's a rural population. It's not a college town or university town. And because it's more, I want to say, more of an old-fashioned rural New York kind of a town, that will be the real test of how usable this technology is. We expect actually those households to embrace it too, because while local foods is trendy and could be coined as modern, it's also the origin of food. So we see that community, you know, rural communities are already eating meat this way. I think they're going to embrace it too.
About the whole food scene, and we've actually touched upon the same theme a couple times in this conversation, that we're really kind of going back to go forward. And you know, maybe I'm going to throw this back at you, and then I'm going to ask Nicola a similar question, but have you, in your work as an agricultural extension, in the agricultural extension program, which is, you know, really a great example of kind of going back to go forward, because so many ag extension programs had seemed to kind of fall off the radar, if you will. I mean, certainly for urban consumers, but now there seems to be a renewed interest in how ag extension can play a part in developing new technologies and developing regional food systems. Have you seen other ideas beyond the sort of meat locker, maybe using technologies like refrigeration or using other technologies to improve people's local food access or local food community?
Sure. I mentioned distribution hubs earlier, or what people are calling food hubs. They're just an opportunity for small-scale farms to aggregate product for distribution, and it's usually characterized by distribution direct to consumers, so not wholesale off to grocery stores or restaurants. I think the the meat locker and the meat locker concept is playing off of the popularity of CSA, that's community supported agriculture, where the consumer pays the farmer in advance and gets a weekly share of the product. And the CSA model, it wasn't initially fueled by technology, but nowadays the best, you know, sort of most efficient for the farm and best service to the consumer are the CSAs, where the consumer can go online and manage their account and even place specific orders using some of these websites. We're about 4 hours outside of New York City, and we have farms here distributing very consumer-specific CSA shares in the city. So that's another technology that's allowing people to get access to locally grown food, regionally grown food. And, you know, consumers, for a number of different motivations, whether it's food enthusiasm and flavor and freshness, or it's social motivation of supporting local economies, avoiding pesticide use, things like that. There's different drivers that are driving people to regionally produced foods or locally grown foods, and they're in that quest, they're always looking to shorten the supply chain, right, to eliminate distributors and grocery stores. So in the beginning, you know, even in the last 10 years, that's been a sometimes clumsy or inefficient for the farm process, but using web and some of the shared distribution, shared refrigeration, and shared freezer space, that straight to the consumer connection is becoming a lot more efficient, which enables us to grow it.
It's so true, and it's amazing how this is all changing kind of right before our eyes. And actually, Nicola, you have done work for many years, which I've followed with great interest, kind of mapping different food landscapes. And I'm curious if in that work of looking at, obviously, refrigeration being your current kind of focus, but looking at some of the other, you know, possible and developing food landscapes for the future, if you've seen other technologies that have had a similar, you know, opportunity for transformation or transformational power to this concept of new uses of refrigeration. Are there other good, you know, almost whether it's the old and new again, or it's really just new technologies in food that maybe some people that are watching don't necessarily know about?
It's a great question. And of course, now I'm trying to think of all the, you know, the best possibilities. While I do that, I think the food hub, model is actually a really important one. And it's so interesting to go back to what Tabitha said, that while, you know, cities are busy demolishing their wholesale food markets, on the one hand, and on the other hand, you know, sustainable food activists are sort of promoting food hubs as the best practice. So there's just this odd disconnect going on between there, and it seems much more interesting to see whether we couldn't just actually reinvent the municipal market to work in today's climate rather than get rid of them altogether. But the other thing that I think was pretty interesting about what Tabitha said is, but of course, you know, we have many, many ways of preserving foods that don't rely on refrigeration. And I think increasingly we are realizing that many of those come with beneficial bacteria, and that my personal feeling is that as we, you know, start to understand what is helpful to have in the gut and how many different diseases are actually connected to our microbiome and so on. And I'm having my gut bacteria sequence right now, so I'm super excited to be a part of that, but and see where my gut bacteria are going wrong. But I think as we start to become more conscious of that, there will actually be an increased value placed on some of those fermented and otherwise preserved, you know, even cheeses and things like that that come with their own bacterial buddies, and that we might start to return to that way of eating for health reasons. And I mean, right now, as Tabitha said, it's sort of very trendy. The fermented, the pickle scene in New York is super hot. But I think that it might actually start to become a much broader trend if it's driven by health rather than simply sort of artisanal foodiness. So none of that was answering your question, Ellen. Sorry. But I do think that, I mean, one interesting thing that that I did come across that I think it's one of the issues around food which has to do with trust. And we're talking about this sort of sociality too. And one of the issues around, you know, doing these things on a community basis rather than an individual or family basis does boil down to trust. And I say this because there was an app recently that you guys may have seen that allowed you to share your leftovers. So you could post, you know, where you had leftovers, it was geotagged, and you know, I could see who had what leftovers all around me and theoretically do a swap. And while logically that's a great way to connect excess food with food consumers, on another level, I think most people's response is like, oh, gross, I'm not going to eat someone else's leftovers. Like, how do I know what has happened to it? So I think, you know, and that's another place where maybe technology can step in again. Maybe there's packaging that shows that, you know, this food is okay. Maybe there's, on the other hand, so there's always, you know, as soon as we create problems, we can create solutions for them and that will probably bring a host of new problems. But I do think that one of the questions that comes back to sort of sharing these things is the need to build in trust too and how you do that. And I think, Matt, that's a really interesting part of your experiment because, of course, for it to really work well, there does have to be sort of buy-in. And that seems like something you have to build slowly and steadily and, you know, may or may not take off. And so it's an interesting aspect of as you design these systems, making sure that alongside the technology, there is also the trust.
I was thinking about fire, you know, about the heat chain and the fire, because we have to think about the new technology about conduction ovens and combi ovens that they don't use fire anymore and letting fire go away from us. But isn't the same result when you cook. But I think it's a huge new thing to look at because many appliances, many equipment are now flashing this the way how and you cook the food, so maybe this is a new kind of technology to see, to look after, and
to as we're looking at the future, really looking at both the introduction of ice and the subtraction of fire from that technological equation of our relationships with food. Does that connect at all to Nicola's question about trust and how we gather and create social bonds around food? Maybe
because
in the UK that I just came across, and now I think it's called something like Dinner Time, but that's it's a one day a month where the community does empty out its fridge. You're encouraged to bring anything that is close to its expiry date or maybe a little past, if it's, you know, veggies, maybe the carrots are a tiny bit wilted or whatever. And the community figures out a way to prepare them and prepare food for everybody who's brought something. out of these things. So, you know, when a carrot is a little past its prime, you can easily still use it, you know, making a stock or whatever. And so people, it's a program in England, and they've actually created a sort of a template for other communities to pick up on it. And I like that idea because, you know, one thing that they, refrigeration, you know, ties very closely to questions about food waste, and food waste is a huge issue. And in the cold chain in general, refrigeration is a great thing for preventing food waste. At the domestic level, it sort of functions the other way around, where we stuff our fridges full of things that we then don't get around to eating and throw them away. So this was a nice opportunity to get the community together, at the same time sort of sneak in some of those cooking lessons that we hear, you know, people who don't know how to prepare certain things or don't necessarily have the skills to cook from scratch. You can do that, and you're saving a bunch of food from the landfill. So I thought that was an interesting way to sort of, yeah, build that trust, build that food knowledge, and also deal with the some of the waste that gets built into domestic refrigeration.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because that it also speaks to kind of expanding the audience of some of these conversations beyond people who would self-identify as foodies. And a question came up on the line, what that term as a marker of a particular audience has come up several times in this discussion. And that's an interesting example, because it sort of opens up the tent of what we're talking about. I also have a question here about how food sociality, as you were talking about sort of waste and getting people together, how does that change with seasonality of food, particularly local food, but also at that sort of interface between where these sort of local food systems are running into the people's interactions with more conventional food systems in their everyday lives? How does that sociality change throughout the year in those models? Maybe Matt, you have a sense of how that might develop in your experiment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have a great insight on it. Seasonality impact, I can't think of anything in particular. At a loss.
Seasonality is one of the interesting, the fascinating casualties of refrigeration, of course, because it is not, combined with breathing and so on. Refrigeration is the reason that we can even, you know, have all sorts of things whenever we want them, because they come from California. But I do think that just as a side note, refrigeration has its own seasonality, which is completely fascinating. So the refrigeration business sort of exists to cater, you know, it has its own sort of gluts and seasons for ice cream, or the, you know, the turkey buildup for Thanksgiving, the cocktail wiener blowout before the Super Bowl, and so on. So refrigerated warehousemen, when you ask them about seasonality, they actually have a completely different set of seasons that are built around commercial food opportunities rather than natural cycles, which is sort of a disturbing and yet interesting phenomenon. But I think one of the things that people think about sustainability, when you're thinking about sustainable food, often you think about seasonal local food. And I think one of the things to remember is that, for example, it can be, you know, a refrigerated container on a container ship is potentially the more carbon neutral solution in a lot of cases, particularly, again, if we're talking about feeding a really large population. So I understand the morning of seasonality that comes with refrigeration, but I tend to think that, you know, that might just be one of the things that we don't prioritize in thinking about our sustainable food future. I'm probably going to get ripped apart now anyway.
Well, you know what? I was going to actually jump in and not rip you apart, but there's been some questions in the chat, but I think it's just a general, maybe a general construct that maybe each person can kind of go through and touch on, because we've all talked about these concepts of local food or food, local food systems or regional food, and then we've also all touched upon this idea of foodies and the higher end and how, you know, this quote unquote local food is more expensive, and it seems like there's always this inherent conflict between, you know, the people that are still dealing with hunger and are probably eating local foods, and people that are on the high income level that are quote unquote foodies that are also trying to eat local foods. And it's interesting that this has been set up like a conflict, but maybe what we could do is start with Sabitha and then go to Matt and then finish with Nicola on, you know, is there necessarily a conflict between, you know, sort of local and hunger, if you will, or foodie and hunger, hungry, or is our technologies like refrigeration or our new technologies and new ways of, you know, consuming food actually helping to bridge and create a convergence so that people who are eating locally aren't necessarily just the foodies. It's that, you know, this is broadening the access to better quality food for everyone. Is there a convergence? Is this technology of refrigeration that we're talking about today helping to bring a convergence between the foodie and the hungry, if you will, or is it actually stratifying these groups even more? So actually, maybe Tabitha, let's start with you, and then Matt, and then Nicola.
When I start to think about it, I think these distract more because people who grow locally, here in São Paulo, for example, want to sell to the municipal market. But if they sell all to the municipal market, they will not have their own food to eat. They will have to buy food from outside São Paulo, for example. So if we don't have a huge cold chain that obliges us to buy every day, it's simple like that. You will buy everyday food. I'm not talking about meat or this kind of food that rotten, this hugeness, but we're talking about lettuce or tomato or food that can feed to end the hunger. But if I think about the converse that the foodies, that people who love the good food could bring to this, the people who just think about a simple way to feed each other, it's good because they will converge probably more time, but they will converge. I think we have this equilibrium between the local food in Brazil and the food that's growing outside of the state, because we have food that we can grow in one state and we can grow in other state that, and it's foody and it's locally and it's good to feed or to experience, you know? So I think we depend on a better way of transportation. It's the first thing. The second thing is about storage and keeping the food fresh.
So part of that is actually technical and logistical. And the other thing I'm hearing from what you're saying, Tabitha, is part of that is the intention to make that convergence is important, and it might not happen on its own, and in some cases it's not happening.
It's so expensive when you grow locally, but when you bring this food with the label and the whole market of locally grow it to the market, to the Pão de Açúcar, to the big chains, is different. Just rich people can buy. But if you buy locally, real at the farm, it's cheap. But people around here don't want to go to the farm to buy. Just if you are foodie, I want to experience with your friends and go to this trip to Santa Adelaide Farm, is different. You are going to experience the chefs. Culinary is another stuff. It's very different.
Now, Matt, to jump to you, isn't that so part of the irony of almost what you've seen in the interest in the Meat Locker Project in New York? It is actually an irony that local foods are necessarily thought of as more expensive. But you've actually seen in your community that there's been some convergence between what you thought were going to be the people interested in this new way of buying and what has actually kind of come about. So what's your sense in the population that you're serving about whether or not maybe we can finally bring some convergence between the quote-unquote foodie population and the still struggling and still hungry or even obese, sort of underserved populations and years where you're working?
Yeah, that has been, to me, an awesome outcome of researching the most efficient way for livestock farmers to sell, because there is, back to the original question, there's a conflict between locally grown foods and sort of the perception that that's what the foodies are buying, and then food accessibility and affordability. And there's a few reasons, I have strong feelings on this topic. There's a few reasons why we have that conflict in locally grown foods. One is that the scale is smaller and that the costs are higher. But another is that the alternative to locally grown foods, conventional foods, are artificially cheap. So as Americans, we expect and demand cheap food, even though it's artificially cheap. It's not representing the real cost. So that said, when it comes to certain products in our region, like fresh produce, the prices will remain high. And as an ag extension and an ag economist, I'm always working on the farmer side to ensure farm viability. And so the pricing has to be where it has to be. But I got so excited about with the Meat Locker and some of this research on meat, is that locally grown meat is actually more affordable than the alternative in terms of dollars per pound when you buy it this way, and it's at the same time, while it's more affordable, is the best way for the farmer to sell. So the farmer has a lot of market options for their livestock. They could sell into the commodity supply and take commodity prices, or they could set up at a farmer's market, which is has labor requirements and has certain risks. But the beauty of the selling animals in quarters and halves and such is that that is the most efficient and profitable way for the farmer to sell, and it happens to be the most affordable way for the consumer to buy. So I was really excited to see that we could bring excellent quality locally grown foods to everyone and just say honestly to them that this is the most affordable way for you to get meat. That's been a great way to not have to have that usual sort of foodie and expense conflict. And in fact, that's part of the freezer program, is that you don't even need to buy a home freezer, which is going to cost you, let's just say $300 to $500. We're going to give you this. We're going to rent you for $3 to $5 a month this communal freezer space. So we're going to address any affordability barriers that might come up and hopefully get more households using locally raised meats.
That surely suggests a convergence, just the $3 to $5 a month. I mean, that surely suggests that people that may be foodies would be interested in it because of the better quality meat. And then it obviously also seems to suggest there are good opportunities for people on the lower end of the income scale who may be dealing with fundamental hunger or food insecurity too. So actually, I just want to switch right over to Nicola and hit her with that same question about, have you seen or are you seeing or do you think that this technology of refrigeration is going to help in the convergence between, you know, I'm framing this as foodie and hungry, you know, just to use mass generalizations for the purpose of the call. But are you seeing that, and do you have good examples of that?
One thing I think is interesting is how refrigeration and food distribution impact the role of women. So frequently, you know, the one-stop shop of the supermarket is something that has enabled, you know, this is a generalization to which you can definitely find exceptions, but it's part of the transition of women into the workplace. So that one-stop shopping, now you can have a dual-income household, it's sort of a luxury, actually, right now, to be able to shop in any other way and to have the time to pick up this at your local butcher and that at your local fishmonger, and then your fruits and veggies at the farmer's market, et cetera. That's a sort of class divide right now of the luxury of time. And we forget that, you know, before the advent of the sort of refrigerator and grocery stores and that sort of level of convenience, it was actually much harder for women to join the workforce and still feed a family, which is still, for the most part, their responsibility. So that's a sort of interesting overlap, and I think what could be promising there are some of these online delivery systems, so that you know, you're able to keep that ability to save the time, no one has enough time, and so you maintain, you know, the time saving efficiency of shopping all in one place. But you combine it with the ability to source that food locally and so on. So I go back to the potential for online delivery systems to really revolutionize this. The other place where, of course, I think they could have a huge impact is in so-called food deserts, which are a very complicated issue. But oftentimes the grocery store does not want to take the economic risk to set up in a certain neighborhood. And then that neighborhood has a harder time having access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And that, again, is where delivery and online ordering, you know, is a possibility, particularly if we could set up sort of lockers where people could receive these deliveries because they're not around during the day, et cetera. So I think there's a huge amount of potential with online shopping and delivering, both to connect to smaller local producers and to connect folks who might not have access or time right now to do that sort of shopping themselves.
So you mentioned, Nicola, the relationship between that that practice of going to the grocery store and the location of work. One thing that that we've been looking at sort of broadly is the relationship of work and health, and how efforts to feed people at workplaces and work sites have sort of taken the idea of eating together and food sociality and turned it into a sort of asset for innovation and for sort of health. And I was wondering what your thoughts on that were, sort of where people are eating together.
That's another area of huge opportunity, smart companies and ones that want to keep their health premiums low, as well as their you know, increased well-being and sort of sense of community among their staff, are really pushing that or finding that food is the way to do that. I mean, I know, and this may even have been at an IFTF event where I was hearing about Kaiser, you know, actually sponsoring farmers markets to take place in their parking lots so that their staff have time. And along with that, they've actually provided, you know, a communal sort of locker freezer system so that people can, I mean, fridge system so that staff can buy food during the workday. You know, the food is coming to them, it's all in the parking lot, and then store it until they have time to take it home. So I think smart companies are definitely picking up on that potential. And I think there's, I mean, again, this is one of those things where I think that it would be nice to live in a world with fewer time pressures, where we could savor, you know, the opportunity to walk down the street and go to the local butcher. But we probably have a greater potential of reaching more people and changing the food system more on a more significant level if we actually try and reach people where they are and reach them in their workplaces where they have a half-hour break, and you can bridge that gap for them rather than expecting people to do a lot of work themselves.
Any other thoughts on that, Matt or Tabitha? If not, we do have a question here about the relationship of this sort of shared communal refrigerator cold case system and food safety issues. And I think that is in part linked to that question of trust that you brought up earlier, Nicola, but really how does this sort of new world of microbial health and seeing microbes as beneficial interface with, you know, our past century of being germophobes for often very good reasons.
And I think it will be very hard for people. It will be very hard for people to get over their germophobia. Again, as you say, it has a strong grounding in reason. I actually think that's a place where maybe technology can help us. Again, people are developing packaging that has all kinds of sensors. The ability to have even those kinds of sensors built into your domestic fridge or, you know, as an attachment to your iPhone or something, and just do a quick scan and make sure the food is okay, that it's not releasing various compounds that might reveal that it has gone bad or whatever. I think that will, or say you're allergic, you can scan it for the presence of particular things. Again, I think hard to ensure trust otherwise, particularly in our society. And so that seems an area to me where with the whole rise of people, you know, being able to put a science lab on a chip and having these very, very cheap sensors, that seems like an area where we might be able to just sort of put some of that food safety in people's hands. Of course, the world of liability and the American legal system is a whole additional can of worms there, and I don't know how you get around that. Food safety is much more than actually is your food safe. It's an entire structure. And perhaps the Chinese have the best chance of reinventing that too. I mean, they have a completely screwed system right now, and they are looking, they are looking to change that, and it might be, an opportunity. We have, again, this is our food safety system is 100 years old, as you know, 1906 and the Pure Food Act, and it's obviously evolved during that time, but we're dealing with a legacy system. Maybe there's a way to reinvent it, and maybe we can then borrow what someone else comes up with.
And I'd like to jump in also on the food safety topic, because it's sort of ironic. I think a lot of people are being driven to local sources because of concerns with the and I'm not doubting the safety of our food supply, but the so-called safe food supply, which is the conventional food supply or the commodity food supply, especially when it comes to meats, USDA inspected large-scale food processing has, you know, begun to be questioned by a lot of people, and that's one of the drivers to local sources. And while something that's unique about meat that's sold in bulk like quarters and halves is that it doesn't have to go through a USDA inspected slaughterhouse legally. You can go an independent, or what's called a custom plant, but that concern over not just sort of microbial food safety, but the full system of what did the animal eat and then how was it handled and such, that's something that's driving people to local foods where there's a greater level of trust because they can meet and ask questions of the person who raised the food that they're going to consume.
But here, everything is so different, guys. It's very different. Everything is so messy. Sorry. Because, for example, we have a law that we can sell the cheese from the raw milk, you know, the best cheese from Minas Gerais, a state very near from São Paulo, is made from the raw cheese, the raw milk, sorry. But you can sell just at the city. You can sell at the state and at the federal level, but don't think about that. But you can buy the fresh raw cheese. There's no problem with that. I can have the cheese from France with raw milk that comes from Europe to here, and I can buy. I can eat it. There's no problem with that. So I don't know. The law, it functions from some kind of stuff, but other stuff, it's massive. So at manipulation, another example, we have a law that say you can use cotton tissues at the kitchen because they propagate the microbicals level if you don't wash, if you don't use this clean. But instead of train and say you have to keep it clean, you have to use this way, no, they just have the law that forbid the use of these in teaching. So it's very messy. It's different because of that. Because I don't know how and to whom the law functions to, you know.
I'm going to take the last question and try to get everyone to answer it. And I'm going to loop in some of the great points that were made by viewers online with really a focus on what the future holds. And so it's interesting because we've now just touched on whether food safety will push us in one direction or another with future technologies and things like trust, you know, in sharing and whether, you know, people will think that it's safe to share these refrigeration technologies. But another key element that might be pushing for new technologies is cost. And actually, someone brought this up, the idea of home refrigeration being sort of an energy suck. And I looked it up quickly. I Googled it, so I'm not sure if this data is accurate. But I saw an estimate that 40% of home energy use is actually just comes from our refrigerators and freezers. And that's actually a really high number. And if, you know, our energy continues to become more and more expensive, which many of us think in the future it will, you know, then what? How does that play into this factor, and how does that change what we're choosing in terms of how we store our food in the future? So I think we should go maybe Matt, then Tabitha, then Nicola for, you know, how do these factors, whether it's food safety or whether it's really energy costs or costs, how will they help and push for new technologies in the future of refrigeration And what do you think some of those new technologies will be?
It's a great question, and I never proposed that the meat locker was going to be more efficient. That said, I think it's going to hold the food for about 100 households and maybe in addition to that about 5 farms. So we'll be providing freezer space bigger than the freezer above your fridge for about 100 households. And I don't know, because we're not up and running yet, what the energy costs will be. So there's that whole very interesting question of would communal refrigeration and freezer space allow people to get refrigerated and frozen space with a lower cost? And that's a great question. But what I do see is, in terms of the cost of that technology, is that additional freezer space to add to your home now costs more than to rent for a few years from communal space. And when I heard early in the conversation someone talking about how Chinese families are just now starting to buy refrigerators even in place of other things, it just struck me that it seems like, depending on the layout of their living, that communal space would, maybe they could jump over and skip home refrigeration and home freezers and go for communal space, and it'd be really interesting to see if that winds up happening somewhere else.
Because I think here we have this example already, because people, small cities, they don't have electrical grid, and one house have a generator, and everybody use their television, it's normal, it's from necessity, and probably this will be the use for the modern way to think about young people around here, because to have a refrigerator, to have a television, it's quite it demonstrates that you are rich. Everybody's going to have one. So I don't know. We are starting to think about sustainability now. So more 15 years, more. I don't know. We are starting to deal about this, because we have a lot of energy, a lot of water, a lot of everything. So we are wasting, and Brazilians are dumb. Probably more. I think probably more. People are starting to notice, then get away from this and start to run with all these we are talking about now. So.
The climate change impact of refrigeration is obviously huge, and it's not just the electrical usage, it's also the refrigerants that we use. So when we replaced CFCs in the 80s, because there was a hole in the ozone layer, we replaced them with something that is a super greenhouse gas, i.e. it has up to 1,000 times the warming potential of carbon dioxide. So there's refrigeration is actually a massive time bomb right now, and the Montreal Protocol is the U.S. has put forward a proposal to scale back these super greenhouse refrigerants, and China actually came on board to figure out that process. This is incredibly important because, of course, China and India are two places where refrigeration is absolutely booming right now. So that's a very important process. As part of my research, I've been visiting some of the scientists who are trying to reinvent refrigeration more radically. There's some really exciting technology out there. People using, inventing thermoacoustic refrigerators that use sound waves and helium to keep food cold. We'll use less than a third of the power of current refrigeration and none of the global warming potential of the refrigerants. There are people working on phase change magnetocaloric refrigerants that rely on certain metals. Alloys have a very huge temperature range at room temperature and can shift, and that's a way of cooling things. So people have prototypes of magnetic fridges. Again, incredibly little power used and none of the global warming refrigerants. People are working on district cooling using deep water sources. So if you're next to a deep water source, you know, you can exploit the heat differential by pumping that. Again, you're not using the refrigerant. It might be a more sustainable system, although you have to think about the energy for pumping. So there are people working on these sort of radically different futures for what a refrigerator, how the physics of refrigeration works. And that will, I think, be increasingly important as we focus on as we hopefully focus on climate change.
Great, thank you guys. Well, we're nearing the end of our time together here, and I just wanted to pick up a few threads. One of the things that I'm really taking away from this conversation at many levels is that all of these changes and these historical trends and possible futures really hinge on the intention that we bring to them to promote particular aspects like bringing people together communally, like making things accessible to people of a variety of interests and income levels when it comes to food, and to really keep an eye on trust and these wider impacts that go beyond even what we think of as the food system and are really global issues. And as we move forward and we look at various specific issues, that really coming back to that intention of what kind of future are you creating in particular places is really the question that we need to keep coming back to. And with that, a recording of this conversation and a summary of it, some highlights, will be up on our blog later this week. And please do keep tuned to the Global Food Outlook page on IFTF's website for our ongoing explorations of food futures. Please join me in thanking Nicola and Matt and Tabitha and Ellen, and everyone have a beautiful day wherever you are. Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Obrigada.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
Thanks.